During that period of time, we had tried to get the Prime Minister of Israel to slow up the settlement policy.
Prime Minister who?
Shamir. To give up, at least temporarily, to hold back on building new settlements. And the only response that we got was, quote, Israel is not for sale, unquote. And certainly that was correct, because there was no reason at that time to stop the settlement policy. There have been reasons since, which is another strictly a philosophical, economic, and political issue. But basically, we were trying to demonstrate that what Israel was essentially doing was trying to build up settlements that would give themselves a substantial foothold next to the border of the occupied territories. And actually 90% of those people who were moving into this area were within a mile or two of the what we call the blue line, in other words, the current Israeli, the previous Israeli border. And a lot of that was around Jerusalem, and this was a move to solidify those areas with the facts on the ground, is one way of putting it. You have to respect those facts in any settlement, final settlement issue. And Israel was preparing for this possibility, and also developing settlements on the Jordanian border, because we're still at war with Jordan and all the Arab countries, and nobody wanted to make peace. So this was part of the long-term security plan, as well as the long-term settlement plan. Certainly, the Prime Minister was correct in their position, and this was basically a plan that was supported by both the Conservative as well as the Labour government. When we agreed, we got the Senate to hold off until the fall the reconsideration of the loan guarantee issue. Everything began to look pretty good. However, in June, things looked pretty good that June. That June 91, fresh publicity started regarding settlements. And it came out because Baker visited Israel. And it was during that time that a big issue was made of a liberal press, of the Israeli starting new settlements, even in the face of Baker's visit. And this created considerable dialogue over the next month or so between the White House and the officers of AIPAC, as well as with the Israeli cabinet, but no progress was made on the subject. On August the 28th, AIPAC received the first indication that we were going to be asked to delay, again, the request for loan guarantees from the Congress. On August 31st, Baker phoned Shamir and then met with Tom Dine, who was the executive director of AIPAC, and Mayor Mitchell, who was the president of AIPAC, and met with a stone wall. When confronted by the proposition that we were being put in an uncomfortable position, that is, AIPAC was being put in an uncomfortable position, Baker countered by saying that we were interfering with the peace process by our activities, we being the Jews and we being AIPAC. And particularly, we blamed the Israeli cabinet. And at that meeting, so Mayor Mitchell reports in our executive committee meeting, Baker became so hot under the collar that his veins actually stood out on his forehead and on his neck. Over the Labor Day weekend, this was August 28th, and over the Labor Day weekend, Shoshana Carton, who was then chairman of the, I always forget the name, the Conference of Jewish Presidents, is what, yeah, the Conference of Jewish Presidents, was in contact with the White House regarding the delay, and she did not respond, but instead held a meeting, which was called the following Wednesday in New York. The meeting of the Conference of Presidents. And it was their unanimous decision to move forward with the request that the congressman should move forward with the request for loan guarantees. The reasoning was the problem of loss of face. Nobody wanted to lose face. And the problem of letting down loyal senators. And the problem of not recognizing the seriousness of the situation. In other words, it was the general attitude that if we backed off, we would lose senators who were out. We had at that time 73 senators who were willing to support loan guarantees. And we realized that we couldn't keep these people in line indefinitely on this issue, that sooner or later, if we lost face, they would back down. So Baker called Tom Dine the following Thursday to meet Tom and Mayor Mitchell at 4 p.m. On Thursday afternoon. The meeting never took place, but rather they were called at midnight and asked that the meeting be held early Friday morning. And Baker indicated that he wanted to negotiate the issue. At that meeting, there were the only people present were Baker, Bush, President of the United States, his advisor on, what was his name, Scowcroft, Tom Dine and Mayor Mitchell, who's president of AIPAC. And Baker indicated he wanted to negotiate the issue, and at that time he laid out his six-point plan for negotiating the issue. But the 6 points failed to outlaw linkage, which was a very big issue with us, in other words, tying the settlement issue to the loan guarantee issue. And it failed to define the commitment in terms of whether or not there would be further delays if we delayed this time and then agreed to hold it off until the 1st of 1992, and to define how much was going to be asked for. In other words, the plan for the loan guarantees is going to be $10 billion, $2 billion a year for 5 years, and it would be a recurring vote. In other words, it would be voted now, but then each year would have to be reinstituted to apply the $2 billion. So the question was, would he then support legislation for the whole $10 billion? So his 6 points did not address that. AIPAC indicated at that time their inability to make any commitment for the Israeli government or for Congress. Again, Baker got so furious with Tom Dine and Mayor Mitchell. And Mayor Mitchell said that he tried desperately to make Baker understand that AIPAC and the Jewish community of the United States does not tell the Israeli government what to do, nor does it necessarily tell Congress what to do. Once a policy is agreed upon, it can help solicit votes in Congress, but it can't enter the legislation. Following that meeting, Baker contacted Kent Conrad of North Dakota and Trent Lott of Mississippi. Incidentally, they were people on the Democratic side of the aisle, but neither had any Jewish constituency, so it was always felt by the Republican administration that these were Democrats that they could talk to. But it was interesting how those two people chose, again, the importance of the effect of the constituency of a supportive Jewish community, that he took those people to try to convince them that his position was correct and that we should postpone the decision for loan guarantees. Let me just state that this became an important issue because as time went on and we realized, Baker and Bush were convinced that it was extremely important to arrive at a peace in the Middle East. And they were willing to sacrifice, and I think we have to credit them, they were willing to sacrifice all and everything to achieve that goal, including losing their temper, including having the Jews of the United States mad at them, and as Bush said off the record one time, Baker said off the record one time, Jews don't vote for us anyhow. So he said, why should we be concerned about the Jewish vote? Obviously, that isn't 100% true. They get a lot of money. The administration gets a lot. The Republican presidential administration gets a lot of money from Jewish pockets. However, going back to my story at the AIPAC Executive Committee, when when he was turned down flatly, he couldn't accept it. Baker was not used to being turned down. He then stomped out of the room and so forth. It was a very hot meeting. 1 week later, on September 12th, a call came from Sununu, who was then the chief of staff. This call came to Tom Dine and Mayor Mitchell at midnight, asking if they would meet at the White House at 7 a.m. He asked me if he would come to the White House, if they would come to the White House at 8 a.m. He later called to say to make it at 7 a.m. And when they arrived, they found themselves meeting with President Sununu, Chief of Staff Sununu, Scowcroft, who was the advisor on security affairs to the White House. At that time, the president began threatening about what he would do to fight against loan guarantees if he didn't get his way on the delays for asking for loan guarantees, or he didn't get his way on the settlement issue. And at that time, Mayor Mitchell's position was as follows, and this is a lesson for all Jewish people to remember. Mayor Mitchell was a wonderful man, said, "Mr. President," he said, "in 1939, a ship came to our shores with over 900 Jewish refugees." And he said, "There was not a voice in America that stood out to save those people from their eventual destruction, which is what happened to them, because at that time, there was no organized Jewish community." And he said, "I remembered all my life since that time that I was going to devote my life to changing that situation, that never again would Jews be put in that position without a fight." And he said, "I want you to know that that's the only reason I'm here, is to save Jews and to prevent Jews from being put in an untenable position again." Mayor said to us as he gave his report, he listened carefully, the president listened carefully, but he did not change his mind. And he said that he would go public, asserting that this would not be an all-out campaign, but he would let the public know his position. It was only after that, at 12 noon on that day, that he actually went public to the point of having a press conference, which was, of course, out of proportion to what any of the AIPAC executives had expected. The public issue of the press conference was something totally unexpected and out of context. These issues were issues that were always settled behind closed doors, but it was important, that important to Bush, and he made some very bad statements during that press conference. It was a noon press conference. Nobody knew it was coming. It just so happened that that very day, AIPAC representatives from all over the country were meeting in Washington. There were about 1,200 of us there, and we all had assignments to go up to Capitol Hill to lobby. And Bush alluded to the fact that Capitol Hill was being invaded by people who wanted to undermine his wishes. And he made very serious, seriously anti-American comments, which he later apologized for in that press conference. It came as a great surprise, and when I arrived at the airport in Washington to come back to Pittsburgh, I was met by reporters. And here's what was published on that day, next morning's paper, 9/13/91. "Leaders of Pittsburgh Jewish community had mixed reactions to their day in Washington yesterday. They were pleased by a generally cordial reception that they received from the offices of Western Pennsylvania congressmen, but there was no denying their disappointment over President Bush's threat to veto loan guarantees for Israel." And they quoted me as saying, quote, "I think it's unfortunate he said that," said Dr. Lade Kessler, a World Herald neurosurgeon who was among the 41 people from Pittsburgh lobbying for prompt congressional approval of a $10 billion loan guarantee. Again, they quote, "He's talking about politics. We're talking about saving lives. I don't know if the president realizes the magnitude of the situation Israel faces involving the absorption of all these people." And marketing for the United Jewish Fund, the marketing is required to raise this money would be enormous if it were done on a private basis, referring to the massive influx of Jews, Soviet Jews into Israel. It would be like us absorbing the entire population of France next year. Making the rounds of congressional offices, I said that they had picked up a lot of concern that constituents didn't understand the difference between loan guarantees and outright grants. And that was an issue that we had to sell. Somehow people have to understand, I said, in quotes, that this is like countersigning a mortgage for your children. This isn't a case of giving out money. Kessler said he stressed the point that guarantees are humanitarian aid that represent freedom, democracy, and progress for refugees flooding into Israel, something the U.S. has supported from the very beginning, and so forth. So at any rate, this was one of the crucial, I think, crucial points of history of the Jewish community and its relationship to the United States government. Nonetheless, after this happened, the offices of AIPAC, and I was among them, met with Senators Robert Kasten and Inouye. Neither are Jewish. And they advised not backing down on our desire to go ahead and request the bill for a loan guarantee. Because they were afraid that they would lose the senators they had then backing the issue. They were the two co-sponsors of the bill. However, it was Inouye who said that he did not want to fight the president. He felt it was wrong to make this issue one of one party against the other party. And therefore, a final decision was made that we would delay to the first, granted 120-day delay. And immediately, nine more senators signed up, countersigned the bill. The president then threatened I'm getting ahead of my story. The president threatened us with a speech from the Oval Office if we didn't do that. That's how serious this issue was. And it was only then that we reached the compromise, and it was Phil Graham that worked out the compromise of 120 days. Phil Graham noted that an Oval Office speech would only divide the country and create an anti-Semitic climate. And we felt that his press conference definitely created anti-Semitism. As a matter of fact, the White House was flooded with anti-Semitic calls after that. It was then that AIPAC began starting to develop a new strategy for the 120 delay. The strategy was, and this is important, we decided to, under the control of AIPAC, a national organization was undertaken, and I was the chairman of that in Pittsburgh, to involve every synagogue in a letter-writing campaign to Congress to support the $10 billion loan guarantees for Soviet Jews in Israel. We heard all sorts of complaints. Well, we have people out of work here. Why not loan guarantees for them? The truth is that the United States underwrites $500 billion in loan guarantees for just such things as food banks and et cetera, et cetera. So that this had nothing to do with that. The big issues came over the question of what the interest rate was going to be. We had people in government at that time who wanted the interest rate to be higher than we wanted it to be. The other issue was what happens, what was it going to cost us in upfront points, so to speak, in order to get the government to sign the note. We finally did agree to a figure. It was not the ideal figure. There are people in many countries who get loan guarantees from us, from the United States, that were better than the deal we finally made, but the Israeli government said, listen, we'll settle for that deal. We realized that there was a lot of hostility still remaining in the administration, Bush's administration. I must say, it was my prediction then, that was in 1991, fall of 1991, that Bush was going to lose the next election. And I knew it at that time because I realized you can't get elected to office in this country if you confront a major humanitarian issue about which you don't look good on. And there was no question that the Jews of this country were going to make it an issue. And it was only one step in the direction, the wrong direction for him to go. He didn't come off looking good. And as a matter of fact, that's really what happened. It was the beginning of the end of his. He was salvaged by some degree by the temporary boost in popularity of the Gulf War, but even in that war, his administration was not steadfast in the support of Israel. For example, they didn't give the Israeli planes the codes, so that if for any reason they had to go out and defend themselves, they couldn't type in the right code so that American planes wouldn't fire on them, things like that. They didn't give us ground maps of the satellite photographs. A lot of things they could have done, and it would have been up to Bush and Baker to order it, and they didn't do. So there was, we did not, though the thing was finally settled, we eventually did get the loan guarantees, we did not leave that administration with the best of feelings. The new president came in, Clinton, in 94, no question there was a different attitude. He had a much more positive attitude, and that's what brought about. It was his attitude and the attitude of our current Secretary of State and the people under them that made the difference in bringing the PLO to the negotiating table, and the history then followed. Bush's reaction to Israel was not a positive one in general. Let me just give some classic examples that were present at the time and even before this this particular issue came up. President Bush made an unexpected statement exposing what he called settlements in East Jerusalem. Now, it was the first time that anywhere is it written that we have settlements in East Jerusalem. Settlements were considered something that was happening in the occupied territories. Nowhere in any of the agreed parlance of political debate or communication did anybody ever use the term Jerusalem as an occupied territory. And so that this is the kind of thing that we got you, that in 1990, for the first time, administration officials told Congress that the Palestine Liberation Organization was fully living up to its commitments to peace and the renunciation of terror. Now, we knew that that was absolutely not the case, but that administration did things like that. He has said, Yasser Arafat at that time in 1988 said openly, he personally authorized the death squads that have killed hundreds of Palestinians who have strayed from the PLO line. And yet he was being given an endorsement by that administration. His top deputy publicly praised the still continuing stepped up cross-border raids against Israel. And this in the face of the fact that our administration officials were saying that they were living up to their commitments for peace. The U.S. is another issue. The U.S.'s reluctance to criticize the PLO contrasts sharply with a flood of statements publicly expressing differences with Israel. Also, little, another issue was that little was said about Jordan's vote to throw Israel out of the UN, Saudi Arabian steps to enforce Arab boycott, and the Arab League pressures on the Soviet Union to close the gates to Jews seeking sanctuary in Israel. So this, I'm talking about 1990, and a Republican administration that was supposedly looking for peace in the Middle East, and this is how they were still showing their Arabist point of view, and why it's necessary for Jews to be involved in pressuring administrations in Congress. And it was only because we had strong support in Congress that we were able to control, to some degree, the general situation as far as the American-Israel relationship. The most important, I think, issue of how Bush assaulted Israel, literally, was that the exodus of Soviet Jewry is the worldwide Jewish community's top priority. Unfortunately, the administration has needlessly linked, then, that was the beginning of it, the housing of Soviet Jews with the issues of the settlements, in other words, which was Israeli policy at that time. I think I did give you as one of the op-eds, the subject of, subtitle is, Whose Land Was It Anyhow? Did I look and see if I gave you that? I think that's under that Bush Baker article that I wrote. So the political aspects of Pittsburgh Jewry is a good one. I think that we have many more people involved these days than we did years ago. When we go down to Washington, the lobby, there's always a substantial number of people on the bus who go to see their congressmen. We raise now in Pittsburgh approximately $100,000 to help support AIPAC. That's not large, but it's certainly something, and it certainly indicates that there's more people involved than just myself. Every congressman from this area, from this district, knows who's who and what's what. We get respect when we appear there. We get our stories get heard. In the city of Pittsburgh itself, we have a lot of good support for Jewish causes, and we are a major active part of the community at large, and I think that we've come a long way. I just want to add some remarks that Howard Braun reminds me my thinking about, and that's the importance of the role of soliciting the government. We have the right to petition our government. That is one of the singularly most important aspects of our democracy. Everybody admires that. On one occasion, I usually, because I've been doing this now for so many years, I'm usually appointed as a chairman of a group, and I take a group, and I'm the main speaker. Naturally, others speak too, and I ask people when we go to the senatorial or congressional office. On one occasion, and I don't remember, I think it was in Congressman Corning's office, I had a group of students that I took, and they were, some of them were foreign students, and one of them was a little girl, little to me, because she was 21 years old or thereabouts, and only 72, so she pulled me aside as we were walking out of the congressman's office, and she said, Dr. Kessler, do you think that I could speak to the congressman? And I said, absolutely, what do you want to speak to him about? And she said, I just want to tell him where I come from. I don't remember where she came from. But with tears in her eyes, she said, if I told the people back home that I was talking to you, sir, they would think I was lying. So that it is something that we have to be proud about. And that's why when Bush made his press conference on September the 12th to the American public about what the 1,200 or so people, he used the term 1,000 people, are surrounding the Congress and carrying out this lobbying against my wishes and so forth, he was talking about one of, he was contradicting on the basic principles of democracy, the right to petition our government. That is a right that we have to respect, we have to participate in, so it never dries up. I want to